So I decided to preach to you today from one of the passages that I deal with in the book, The Moral Teachings of Jesus. That passage is Luke 12, 13 through 21. It's a challenging passage, and I think it's one that can speak to all of us if our hearts are open, and so that's my prayer. I'll read the text now. I think it's going to show up on the screen as well. I don't know, but anyway, I'll read it. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, "What should I do, for I have no place to store my crops?" Then he said, "I'll do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul," this is hilarious, "I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves but are not rich toward God." I always pick only the easiest passages. So here we go. Many a family relationship has died at the law office around the time that the will is read. Fresh with grief, family members now must face the division of property. When it doesn't go the way someone expects or that someone thinks would be fair, it can often get really ugly really fast. It's so unseemly, of course, the body's barely cold and the children or the spouse or the grandchildren or whoever are fighting over the worldly remains of a person hardly dead. In ancient Israel, problems with inheritance were baked right into the law itself. The main legacy of most dead people in Israel was land, not money. Under the inheritance laws, upon the death of the father, leadership in the family and a double share of the inheritance went to the eldest son. I would like to say, as an eldest son, this seems perfectly fair to me. Single shares went to other sons. So if there were like five sons, son number one would get two shares and the next one would get one each. And daughters would get nothing unless there were no sons. This was written into the law. Now fathers could choose, they weren't supposed to, but they could demote the firstborn son and elevate a later son if they wanted to. And you may remember some stories in the Old Testament where this happens. But this more or less ensured absolute hatred between the sons. It all sounds like a recipe for lovely family harmony, don't you think? As our text opens this morning, Jesus is being asked to weigh in on an inheritance dispute. "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Now, I think two things could possibly be going on here. One is that the father has already died. The elder brother has decided not to divide the estate right away, but instead to wait a little while, or a long while, making the younger brother impatient to gain his share. Or the division of the estate has been made, but the younger brother is unhappy with the unfairness of it all. In other words, it may have been done according to the law, but the law itself seems unfair. And Jesus, who was supposed to be able to solve every problem, is presented with this problem. The son, the younger son, is trying to get Jesus involved in an inheritance dispute. And Jesus says, "Friend," which doesn't sound like an especially friendly moment. "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" Jesus was about many things in his ministry. You know what he did? Preaching, teaching, healing, exorcism, all kinds of things. But he did not do inheritance disputes. He just didn't do that. He set a limit there. He knew what his ministry was about, and settling inheritance disputes was beyond his boundaries. Many of us in this room have faced crossroad moments in our lives, probably, when somebody wanted us to get involved in their agenda that took us, if we were to say yes to it, that would have taken us beyond our boundaries. I need you to do this for me. This is really, really important to me. If you care about me, you will do this for me. And we've had to say no. Boundaries are important. Jesus had to set boundaries. Here's an interesting story from ministry. I remember one time I had counseled a terribly conflicted couple that was having all kinds of problems. I did my best. I shouldn't have even taken it on, probably. And after a while, this couple broke up. I probably did 4 weeks or 6 weeks of counseling with them. And that was it, a fail. It happens in ministry. And about 6 months later, the wife had filed for divorce, and she contacted me and asked me if I would testify on her behalf in her divorce proceedings, based on what I had heard in the counseling. And I said, no, thank you. And then, with the desperation and anger that often accompanies divorce, she said, I am going to subpoena you to testify in court. And I said, go ahead and try, but there is no way that I will violate the clergy role by testifying on anybody's behalf in court. Now, I didn't know if that was going to stand up in court. I did some exploration of Tennessee law, and it looked like I would probably be okay. But I knew that this was a boundary that I could not cross. And I think the law would have been with me. But even if it wasn't, I was willing to go to jail rather than testify in somebody's nasty divorce, revealing the secrets that I had learned in the counseling room. Jesus set a boundary, but he used the question to advance an agenda of his own ministry that we should take seriously, because he took it seriously enough that he talked about it a lot. And it's encapsulated in this statement: take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Jesus talked a lot about greed. Money, wanting stuff, lots of stuff. In the New American Standard, he goes on to say, a New American Standard, I don't usually love that translation, but it's often kind of literal, and so this is what it reads, next line: for not even when one has an abundance does one's life consist of possessions. Yikes. This is a statement to be taken very seriously. Not even when you have an abundance does your life or mine consist of our possessions. Now, the aggrieved younger brother would probably be very unhappy with this statement. From his perspective, his concern is not about greed, it's about justice. It's about what's fair. If you or I were being ripped off in a business deal or felt that we were being cheated out of our rightful part of an inheritance, we would probably be very offended if somebody said, you're being greedy. We would say, I just want what's fair. But Jesus here is not interested in what we think is fair. He's interested in the heart condition of the younger brother, which he calls greed. Now we're going to do a little Greek. This is fun, okay? The Greek word here that is translated greed is pleonexia. It's something to try out at your next dinner with somebody, okay? Pleonexia. Pleonexia. Pleonexia is the problem. What is pleonexia? The insatiable desire to have stuff. The arrogant assumption that other things exist and other people exist for ourselves. Or a morbid desire for possession of material things. Imagine going to the doctor and the doctor says, Ken, I'm afraid you have pleonexia. What's the prescription? Well, we'll get it a little bit later in this. Pleonexia. It sounds like one of those like pharmaceutical ads, you know? You need some pleonexia? Right. Not even when one has an abundance does one's life consist of possessions. Here the word life is zoe, a Greek word which means true life, real life, like abundant life, fullness of life. Jesus is saying to the younger brother, dude, I picture Jesus saying, dude, even if you were to get what you're looking for, it would not make you happy. It is not what really matters. It should not be the center of value in your life. If you try to make it the center of value, you will be sorely disappointed because one's life does not consist in possessions. This is a reminder that Jesus understood that there are many ways to miss the mark. Like, for example, in relation to stuff, here, it's not just like about cheating somebody or whatever. It's also about valuing things too heavily that should not be valued disproportionately. So think about all the things that we value in life. Part of what is spiritually healthy is to value things in the proper proportion. St. Augustine talked about disordered loves. If you love your stuff more than your family, it's a disordering of love. If you love anything more than God, it's the ultimate disordering for Augustine. Jesus seems to be warning this person about loving stuff too much. He'd probably just say, all I want is my share. I want to say, and maybe you have seen this, maybe it's been an issue for you or people you know, possessions can often be the object of disordered love. Possessions can glitter, can shine, they can bring prestige, they can bring status, they can make us happy. We like to have cool stuff. Our advertisers play on our desire to have cool stuff. We like to have stuff that is better than other people's stuff. We like to have stuff that is better than the stuff that we grew up with. And now I'm going to tell you a story about what happened to me 2 weeks ago when something that I thought was pretty cool, here's what happened. I reached a few years ago and bought a Lexus. And I was pretty proud. It was silver. It had great gas mileage, and it was a Lexus. I had never driven a nice car. But 2 weeks ago, I went out to a middle school track near where I live. It was 95 degrees. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I took my keys, and I put them under a tree in an extra pair of shoes, because who wants to have keys jangling around when they're running? Don't do this. Okay. On the third lap, I came around that track and my car was gone. Somebody had tracked me. They got my keys. They got my car. They got my wallet, which was in my car. They got everything that was in the car. And it's gone. And 2 weeks later, it's never coming back, apparently. There's been a rash of car thefts in Atlanta, but it wasn't going to happen to me on a 95 degree, 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday kind of day. There are many things that make me feel angry about this story, but the main thing is, not the main thing, but one of them is I liked that car. I liked how I felt in that car. Now I am driving, and I think we're not going to replace that car, partly as a lesson to me. Now what I'm driving is my wife's 2015 Dodge Grand Caravan. Not a lot of status or sexiness associated with a 2015 Dodge Grand Caravan, but it gets you there, doesn't it? Our kids call that car the Big Cheese. So, silver Lexus, Big Cheese. I learned some things. One thing, never ever. So now, like, my keys and my wallet and my phone are in my possession at all times. Like, you know, the world is not as safe as it was. But I also learned that I had perhaps unduly valued that cool car. So my penance says I'm going to drive the Big Cheese for a really long time, probably. I've had grown children tell me that about their dad who seemed to love his boat or his fancy car more than he loved them. I've seen grown men polish their cars to a spit shine every weekend while the children wait patiently for a chance to play catch. Stuff is nice, but life is more than stuff. If we get that wrong, we'd get a whole lot of other things wrong. Jesus was a great diagnostician of the human heart. He understood about disordered loves and ultimately about the need to love God and love people with everything else falling below that. One reason it was kind of cool to have Alexis was I grew up in modest circumstances. There was dad who had a mid-level government job and mom who didn't work and four of us. We drove cars that would make the big cheese look like a really cool car. We had very little money. I remember watching my dad sweat it out at the end of every month to see if we were going to get through the month. And every year, we dreaded the visit of our cousins from Pennsylvania who always had a new car or a new RV like every summer. And they would come to the house and they would pull up and like, I remember my cousin like getting out of the car and the first thing he would say is, "You all still driving that old station wagon?" They were defining their worth according to the coolness and newness of their stuff, and we didn't measure up. Now, the fact that when you looked under the hood of that family, there was a lot of misery, abuse, and violence, and unhappiness, but man, they had cool stuff. Jesus tells a parable to drive the lesson home. It's a familiar one. You have a landowner who has a fabulously successful crop, and what he decides to do with it is to pull down his barns and build bigger ones and to live off that amazing crop for a long time, to eat, drink, and be merry. It doesn't seem to occur to him to give any of it to his hungry neighbors, to sell any of it maybe at a discount to people who are a little low on cash, to provide any assistance to probably 90% of the population that was living hand to mouth, day to day, praying and hoping for daily bread. The idea of people not having enough to eat is a long-standing human problem. He doesn't think about any of them. He thinks about putting his feet up and watching Netflix every evening and never helping anybody and never working again. And the way Jesus tells the story, God says, "You fool, this night your life is demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" This is a major concern of Scripture, the indifference of those who have toward those who don't. God's heart for the poor and the hungry. I'm glad we prayed for Gaza today. The outrage should cry from all of our hearts to heaven and to Washington. You know, the story of a person who has everything and thinks that they're going to be able to enjoy it for a long time, and then their life is taken from them, actually reminds me of another story. We knew a couple where they had fabulous success in business and more power to them. And this is a couple in their early 60s, and they decided to build the perfect dream house. And they spent like a year and a half building the dream house in the mountains that had everything they wanted. And before they could enter the house, the man died. He never got into the house that they had spent so much time and money building. We think we have guarantees of forever, and we think we're going to be able to enjoy our stuff forever, and sometimes our life is required of us. Jesus concludes this story, "So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." In both Jewish context and first century Palestine, and then later in Christian teaching, being rich toward God pretty clearly meant caring for the poor. How one could be rich toward God is to give generously to the poor. How to give to the poor is a matter of judgment. Whether to give to the poor is not optional in God's will. Every church needs to have benevolence. offerings, and every, I think, Christian family needs to ask, how are we giving to the poor? The rich man's problem was that he was rich toward himself and not toward God. He did not attend to the poor, he did not attend to his neighbors, and then God suddenly chose to attend to him, and he was gone. What God found was a man abundant in earthly possessions, but poor in the treasury of deeds that God values. And this is not how any of us want to be found. So I think the end of the matter is this. When Jesus taught us to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves, and to not be fixated on any other thing, everything falling below that, he meant it. And he meant it in part because the spiritual, theological, moral, they all intertwine for Jesus. Only when we are rightly related to God will we be rightly related to other people, and will be rightly related to our possessions. So, like I wrote about the moral teachings of Jesus, but in writing about it, I discovered that the moral teachings of Jesus are actually fundamentally spiritual teachings. If we want to be right towards our cars and our houses, if we want to be right towards people, our heart needs to be right towards God, unflinchingly committed to God alone, everything else falling into place around that. So at one level, this is a message that says, give generously, spend modestly, don't get too attached to stuff. But at another level, this is a message from Jesus that says, love God with everything you have, love your neighbor as yourself, and let everything else fall into place around that. And that includes our stuff. It includes a lot of other things too. So the question that we always should face on a Sunday morning at church is, who do we love and what do we love? Where is our heart? This is a parable that teaches us something about that.